It's an honor and a privilege to be here tonight. I'd like to thank the Burlington United for Peace and Justice movement. We had an interesting discussion prior to this event tonight, and we talked about issues pertaining to, how we, the conscience of America, can better organize ourselves to be more effective in getting points of view that are beneficial to all of us to be part of our national policy. It was an interesting discussion. I have to say that I've traveled the country and I've traveled the world dealing with movements of conscience, and the Burlington Peace and Justice Movement is one of the more forward-leaning organizations, and I would encourage everybody in this audience to give them their full support, because they are in the process of setting a blueprint. Setting a blueprint that will not only be beneficial for Burlington and Vermont, but I believe will set a model that can make peace and justice movements across the country and indeed around the world coordinate their efforts and cooperate much more efficiently and bring to fruition the high ideals that are set forward in the mission statement. I understand there's a number of people from the International Socialist Organization here tonight. Is that true? ISO? Anybody? It's okay. I'm with you, man. I'm a conservative Republican, but we're on the same side, so that's all right. I was warned that I'm going to be held to account. You know what? I want to be held to account. One of the important things about this event tonight isn't my ability to provide you with a monologue. Oh, I can do that, and I'm going to do it for the next 45 minutes. But that's not what makes an event like this special. What makes an event like this special is the debate, discussion, and dialogue that hopefully will occur as a result of my challenging you with some statements. And I'm going to challenge you. I could come up here and sugarcoat things, give you what you want to hear. I've figured out the peace movement and the progressive movement well enough. I'm an old intelligence officer, and I can push the buttons that generate applause as well as any politician. But I'm not a politician. I'm not running for office. I don't want your vote. I don't want your vote. What I want is a commitment for every man and woman in this audience to be a better citizen. To be a better citizen. Now, how do we begin being a better citizen? If you call yourself an American, if you say, I am an American, I am a citizen of the United States of America, yeah, you may have a birth certificate that gives you that status, or if you emigrated in, you took a test, you raised your hand, took an oath, and you got your citizenship. Now, it doesn't make a citizen. The only thing that makes a citizen of this country is somebody who knows and lives the ideals and values that define who we are and what we are as a nation. And ladies and gentlemen, there's only one document that does that, and that's called the Constitution of the United States of America. And if you can look me in the eye and tell me that you have read this document, that you have absorbed this document in its totality, and you rely on this document to guide your day-to-day actions as a citizen of this country, then you've earned the title Citizen of the United States of America. But if you haven't, you're faking it. And if you're faking it, then you are the reason why our country is headed down the path that it's currently headed on. Because this is a country that is defined by a document that doesn't say, I, the President of the United States of America, or we, the Congress of the United States of America. It begins, we, the people of the United States of America. And if we, the people, have voluntarily abrogated our responsibilities of citizenship by failing to stand up and defend and live our lives in accordance with this document, then don't point an accusatory figure at those whom we elect to higher office when they don't act in accordance with our will. Because what is our will if it deviates from the document that says America? You know, the president just signed some sort of military support legislation that suspends habeas corpus. Now, I know I'm just preaching to a choir here, and you guys are sort of a progressive, enlightened audience. Go walk the streets of Burlington. Go up to the average person in Burlington. Maybe Vermont's different. You guys are different. Go to New York. I do this in New York. And just go up to them and say, hey, they suspended habeas corpus. Huh? It's all Latin to them. Well, it is Latin, but it means a little bit more than just show me the body. It's a principle set forth in the Constitution of the United States of America. And when the President of the United States signs a signing statement on a piece of legislation that suspends habeas corpus, my God, ladies and gentlemen, that should put every one of us in the streets screaming revolution. Because that's what we're supposed to be fighting for. Peace and justice is great. I'm a supporter of peace and justice. But you know, the Constitution speaks about the rule of law. It provides a framework, ideals, and values that represent peace and justice. You can't have peace and justice without the rule of law. And the Constitution defines the rule of law that we're supposed to live under. Habeas corpus is suspended. Torture. There's another issue. We don't torture people, but we do. Why aren't Americans out in the streets screaming bloody murder that the Constitution is being trampled? Because they don't know the Constitution. They have no clue what's in the Constitution. They haven't read it, they don't understand it, and they haven't incorporated it into their daily lives. So there's the challenge right off the bat. How can we defend a document we don't know? And all those wonderful people that say support the troops. Support, heck, I support the troops. I was one of them. But one thing I know about the troops is they all took an oath to uphold and defend that Constitution. Against all enemies, foreign, and here's a little phrase not too many people pick up on, and domestic. And on close reflection, one will find that the greatest threat to the Constitution of the United States in recent history doesn't come from abroad, but comes from within, from the very administration that sits in the seats of power as we speak. That's the number one threat to this country. That's the only threat that has taken away constitutional rights. That's the only threat that's turned its back on the values and ideals set forth in the Constitution, and the American people remain mute because they don't know what it is that's happening. They can't comprehend it. So there's the challenge, ladies and gentlemen. What are you going to do as citizens of this wonderful country? Go out and protest? Go out and have demonstrations? Based on what? Before you talk about having a protest or demonstration or taking any action, go back and read that document. It's a relatively simple document. Read it. Think about it. Talk about it. Discuss it. Debate it. And then bring it into your lives and say, this is what I stand for. And people keep coming up and saying, what do we do? What do we do? Where do we go? I feel so powerless. I don't know what to do. Tell me what to do. You read the Constitution, and you live the Constitution, you'll know what to do. It'll become so obvious it won't even be funny. Because suddenly you'll be empowered with a light that says, this is who I am. This is what I stand for. Suddenly, when you take a look at the actions of those whom you elect to higher office, you'll say, you're not doing what we want you to do. And we're going to hold you to account. We're going to take you to task. And you can be specific about it now. Why did you allow the president to suspend habeas corpus? This is a constitutional crisis. It really is. And when people say, ah, but we're at war. Those terrorists have come and attacked us, and they've done horrible things. And you know, we need security. And the Constitution's not a suicide pact. It's not a suicide document. And we've got to adjust to defeat those terrorists. You know, just remind them that Arlington is full of graves of men and women who gave their lives in defense of the Constitution. The Constitution is a suicide pact, ladies and gentlemen, because without that document, we don't have a country worth dying for. And if you allow the government to shred this document in the name of security. As Benjamin Franklin said, those who will give up their liberty in the name of security deserve neither. And that's what's going to happen. The terrorists win. The terrorists are winning now. Not only in the field of battle in Iraq, they're winning here at home. We're doing exactly what they want us to do. We're destroying the very thing they oppose. They're winning, and we're doing nothing about it. We're doing nothing about it. So there's the first challenge to you. Are you a good citizen? Are you acting as a citizen? Because if you are a good citizen, then you should be really perturbed about what's going on today in Iraq and Iran. You know, that statement you read, I appreciate it. It's nice words, but I took exception to a couple of things. Hey, you put out a litany of, that bothers me when a lawmaker or a representative of a lawmaker refuses to acknowledge that the invasion of Iraq was illegal. Because it was. One of the basic reasons to oppose this war is the Constitution of the United States. Oh, there's that document again. I wish he wouldn't talk about it. He hypes that thing so much. Article 6. When we enter into a treaty or an agreement that's ratified by 2/3 of the United States Congress, it becomes the law of the land, supreme law of the land. We signed the United Nations Charter. And the United Nations Charter provides two conditions under which nations may go to war. One, Article 51, self-defense. You attack me, I get to defend myself. It's the name of the game. The other one is, if in accordance with a Chapter 7 resolution, the Security Council of the United Nations finds that a condition or threat exists that warrants international military intervention, it may so authorize this intervention, and then the member states of the United Nations community can act on this authorization. Neither condition existed when we went to war in Iraq. But a lot of people get a little dismissive. They say, well, that's just international law. No, ladies and gentlemen, it's the Constitution of the United States of America. And if you're willing to hedge on that, what's next? Habeas corpus? Yes. We're apparently willing to hedge on that. What's after that? Torture? Yes. And then what? Step by step by step, the rights that separate us from the rest of the world as people of ideals and values worthy of embrace are gone. They're gone. We went to war in Iraq illegally. That's one of the most important things to recognize. It's not just about the hyping of the war, the selling of the war, the misrepresentation of facts, the lies, etc. We went to war in violation of the law. Now today we have people that say, well, we're against this war in Iraq. It's amazing how many Americans are against this war in Iraq today. I'm impressed by the numbers. I mean, the president's ratings are down to like 31%. That means that there's a whole bunch of people out there, 69% or so, that are against the president. They tell me that like 65 to 67% figure holds true for people who are against the war in Iraq right now. That's impressive. And, you know, the anti-war movement feels like it deserves a big pat on the back because they accomplished something really cool. You know, because the war was the number one issue in this election. The war is what got the Democrats into power in Congress. That's the thing that pushed it over. All these anti-war people. Ladies and gentlemen, there's hardly any anti-war people in this country. I think we got them right here in this audience. You know, but outside of that, we don't have anti-war people. You know, when you take a look at the period of time leading up to our invasion of Iraq, I think, you know, some figures hold 18%, some say as high as 21% of Americans were against the war, anti-war, because it was the wrong thing to do. See, that's a good reason to be against the war. It's the wrong thing to do. It's wrong. It's wrong. I'm against this war because it's wrong. I'm against this war because it's a violation of international law. I'm against this war for any number of reasons. Articulate them. But the people who populate this 65 to 67% figure today aren't against the war because it's wrong. Heck, even the senator's not against the war because it's wrong. He's against the war because we're losing. And so is the rest of America. We're against the war because we're not winning the war. Imagine where we'd be with the percentages had the president gone in violation of international law, lying to us about weapons of mass destruction, successfully toppled Saddam Hussein from power, and then put in a place, a free and democratic society that's flourishing. And there's no insurgency. And it set in motion a series of events that had democracy flourish in Iran and in Syria and elsewhere. How many Americans do you think would be against this war? Not hardly anybody. Because we won. And what does that say about us as a people? That we're willing to violate international law, willing to violate everything we stand for as a nation, so long as we win? There's a fundamental problem here, ladies and gentlemen. So be careful resting on your laurels about this wonderful victory we just got in the election with this new Democratic Congress that's suddenly empowered by the will of the people. What did I just tell you the will of the people is? Stop losing. Stop losing. Not stop the war. Stop losing. If the president can come up right now and put his generals in front of the TV camera and they can present a plan that said, we're going to send 20 to 50,000 more soldiers, sailors, airmen, and marines into Iraq, and we're going to do the following with them. We're going to increase the level of violence. We're going to suffer more casualties. But in 6 months to a year, we're going to win. The vast majority of Americans will say, okay, all right, go for it. It doesn't matter that we went to war illegally. It doesn't matter that we got lied to by our elected representatives. We want to win. And where's the danger in this? Not that we're going to withdraw from Iraq. I mean, when you lose a game, you lose a game. And I think there's growing recognition that we've lost this war in Iraq. We're not going to win it. And that's what's frustrating. Then why are our troops there? Why are they dying if we're not going to win? It's not about why are they dying in support of a false cause. An illegitimate war. Why are they dying if we're not going to win? Do you see the danger here? Because if I mention the word Iran, people are going to say, well, Scott, there's no way the president's going to war in Iran because we're getting beat in Iraq. No. As the coach of a football team, if I lose a game, do I fold up the team and go home, or do I look for the next game to win? And I'm telling you right now, the president and the Congress and the majority of the American people are looking for the next win. Listen to the statement of the gentleman representing Senator Leahy. We're bogged down in a war in Iraq while Iran pursues its nuclear ambition unchecked. If that ain't throwing down the gauntlet, what is? Iran pursues its nuclear ambition unchecked. Oh, really? Now what do you want to do, Senator Leahy, Mr. Anti-War, with this unchecked nuclear program? You going to check it? How are you going to do that? Peacefully? Nonviolently? In accordance with international law? Or are you basically rubber stamping the approach already underway by this administration to do what? Remove the regime in Tehran. Because if someone thinks this is truly about Iran's nuclear program, you're wrong. Just like it wasn't about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction program. Weapons of mass destruction was basically a tactic used by the administration to exploit the ignorance of the American people. And what happens when you're ignorant? You're afraid. Afraid of the unknown. It's natural. I don't like to go into swamps at night. I don't like going to swamps, period. But at night, it's really bad because I don't know what's out there. Every little thing that bumps up against me scares the heck out of me. Irrational fear, if I did a study about the swamp, I'd know exactly what's in that swamp, what can and can't hurt me. But I can't see it, and I'm afraid of it. I'm fearful of it. When you say something like weapons of mass destruction, already you're creating fear. How do you define it? Most Americans don't know how to define it. WMD, cute phrase, WMD. I'm afraid of the unknown. The president says it's there. My God, we've got to do something about it. Go to war? Yeah. Go to war against who? Iraq. Why? Because Saddam Hussein's an evil man, a bad guy. What did Saddam Hussein do? Everything. Anything you can possibly imagine, he did it. He did it. Think about leading up to the war. If the media or anybody came on and said Saddam Hussein sent a rocket to the moon and killed every man, woman, and child on the moon, we would have, of course he did. He's a bad man. We were pre-programmed to accept at face value everything negative about Saddam Hussein. And believe me, there's a lot negative to be said about the man. But let me give you a simple fact, ladies and gentlemen. If he was guilty of all the crimes that we've accused him of, and let me remind you that we have not been able to back up a lot of these accusations with fact as of yet, even though we've occupied the country for more than 3.5 years, but if he was guilty of every crime, he would have killed 400,000 Iraqis over the course of 30 years. It's a lot. I'm not being trivial about it. But I'll tell you what, George W. Bush, by invading Iraq, has killed 655,000 in 3 years. So now tell me, who's the bigger criminal? Oh, but it's easy to pick on old George, the beady-eyed, narrow-eyed man from Texas. How about our lovely Bill Clinton? In the decade of economic sanctions, Bill Clinton was responsible for the slaughter of 1.5 to 2.2 million Iraqis. And yet America didn't weep too much. And look how easy the American public accepted the president's dismissal of the 655,000 number. He just dismissed it, said it wasn't true. Most Americans went, oh, okay, good. Thank you, Mr. President, for clarifying that issue. Now, let's compare and contrast the relative lack of angst in this country over 655,000 dead Iraqis during the current occupation, up to 2.2 million during the decade of sanctions, and say the national suffering we had for 2,000 people who died in Katrina, or the 3,000 people who died September 11th. I'm not minimizing either one of those tragedies, but the total combination, there's 5,000 people. And look at all the attention the media gave, all the outpouring of support that was put out there. Why? Because they're Americans. Apparently, American life has a lot more value than the life of an Iraqi. A lot more value. Apparently, for all the talk we have of peace and justice and ideals and human rights, we judge human rights and the value of human life differently when we say American and anybody else, especially brown people from that part of the world who don't practice our Christian faith and they wear scarves and weird stuff. Yeah, those brown people, they don't appreciate life as much as we do. Life isn't as valuable to them. Basically, it takes about 10-20 of them to die before they feel the pain that we feel with one dead American. And that's basically what the American public's saying with its total apathy to these figures that are being put out there. And what's dangerous about this is that we 300 million people populate this country. We're the most technologically advanced nation on the face of the earth. But at the end of the day, we still are populated by collectively the most ignorant group of people that populate the face of the earth about the world we live in. About the world we live in. How stupid can we be to sit there and say Iraq? And you know, it's so easy right now. We got politicians going, we need to break the country up into three parts. There's the solution. As if that worked in history. I mean, isn't how we got in this problem to begin with? A bunch of drunken French and British generals at the end of World War I drawing lines on the map. And now we want drunken American generals to draw lines on the map? There's a solution right there. But we're going to draw it because we know Iraq, ladies and gentlemen. We really do. It's as easy as this. Kurd, Shia, Sunni. If they just break up, it'll be all solved. That seems to be the solution that a lot of people are pointing to. Kurd, Shia, Sunni. Wow, what if I say Kurd and I go, well, which Kurd group do we want, the KDP or the PUK? Huh? Oh, we didn't know that there was two major parties in Kurdistan. Did you know that as recently as 1997 they were at civil war against one another? Huh? Do you know that they hate each other? Huh? Do you know that Kurds themselves are broken down into Sunni and Shia groups? Huh? You know that a lot of Kurds are loyal to Iran, a lot of Kurds are loyal to Syria, and then there's another Kurdish group operating in northern Iraq called the PKK, or the Kurdish People Party out of Turkey? Huh? We're just going to break it down into Kurds, ladies and gentlemen, and create Kurdistan. That's going to work. Sunni. Under Saddam, Sunni was relatively easy because it was pretty much secular. Sunni Arabs, you could speak of that. Except it really wasn't that easy. Saddam knew this. That's why the Ba'athist Party had policies downplaying tribalism. They didn't want the tribes to be there because Saddam wanted this unified vision of Iraq where everybody was an Iraqi first and whatever they were after that second. Imagine that. Isn't that what we proclaim to be trying to achieve today? The same thing Saddam was trying to achieve? Maybe he was on to something. I don't know. But what I do know is that the Sunnis, there's no such thing as Sunni Iraq. We talked about the Sunni Triangle. You see that on TV all the time. The nice little Sunni Triangle where all the Americans are dying, or the Sunni province of Anbar where a lot more Marines are dying. The Sunnis. Which ones are we talking about? The Ubaidis? That's a tribe. There's lots of tribes I can throw out there. The Nasiriyas. Go on and on and on. There's dozens of big Sunni tribes, hundreds of lesser Sunni tribes, none of which get along to each other. Some of them are secular. Some of them are not so secular. Some of them are Sufists. Some of them are Wahhabists. Some are fundamental. No, we're going to create Sunni Iraq. Then there's the Shia, the majority population in Iraq, the singular homogeneous Shia population. Oh, really? Which group are we going to give our support to? The indigenous Shia of Iraq that seem to be flocking around the Muqtada al-Sadr? No, we're at war with him. Are we going to support the Shia that came to Iraq after more than 20 years exile in Iran? The Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. There's a name that says it all, ladies and gentlemen. The Islamic Revolution in Iraq. The Badr Brigade. Are we going to support them? No, we're not supporting them either. Are we going to support the Dawah Party? Again, an extreme Islamic fundamentalist group supported by the Iranian government that tried to assassinate Saddam Hussein in the village of Dujail in 1982 during a time of war. You know, the crime that Saddam Hussein's been charged with and found guilty of and he's going to hang for. Killing 149 Dawah sympathizers after they tried to assassinate him in time of war. Could you imagine what would happen if we went into armed conflict with Mexico and a Mexican-American town on the border with Arizona during the visit of the President of the United States conspired to assassinate the President of the United States, being paid for by the government of Mexico that we're at war with? How do you think we'd react to that town? What do you think we do when we rounded up the perpetrators? I think we got a clue what we do, ladies and gentlemen. It's called Guantanamo Bay. It's called Abu Ghraib. It's called torture. It's called secret prisons. It's called the suspension of habeas corpus. But Saddam's going to swing for this. So are we going to support Dawah? No, we're going to support the Shia. Shia, don't confuse me with these little subgroups here, Mr. Ritter. The Shia. Well, which ones? The ones that are theocratically aligned to Qom, an Iranian city, or Najaf, or Kabbalah, the different madrasas or religious schools. Which Shia group are we going to support? The point is, we don't understand Iraq. The people who are planning this war and implementing this war don't understand Iraq. We don't have a plan. Our plan was to go into Iraq, remove Saddam Hussein from power, and then immediately move on and achieve regional transformation in the Middle East in accordance with the national security strategy of the United States, spreading democracy to Iran, to Syria, and to other nations. Well, the Iraqi people had a vote in this, not the one with the purple finger revolution, but the one with the finger that pulls the AK-47 and RPG. And they voted against making the occupation of Iraq easy for the United States. And we are bogged down without a plan, without a clue. Support the troops? What's the military mission today in Iraq? To bring democracy? No, we gave up on that one. It was to get rid of Saddam Hussein. I think we sort of succeeded at that. Then it was to install democracy. We're not there. Fact is, the current plan talks about, in addition to splitting up Iraq, the possibility of installing a five-person junta to govern Iraq as a dictatorship. Things come around in a circle. And The other one, we haven't done a good job with the oil either. How much oil are we pumping out of Iraq right now? None. The bottom line is Iraq is not the wonderful exporter of oil that we could be. And I'll diverge for a second just to point out that if this was all about oil, we've done a pretty crappy job. I mean, which tells me it wasn't all about oil. It was about something more than oil. And there's is something called global hegemony, American empire, American imperialism, that speaks more to power than to a specific aspect of power. But then again, you'd have to be a good American citizen to recognize that. But most Americans just sit at home and turn on American Idol and I don't know what some of those other popular shows, Deal or No Deal. There's a good one. Deal or No Deal. No Deal. Stunning what we watch on TV. It's stunning how we allow the media to spoon feed us poison. Everybody blames the media. I blame the media. I'm highly critical of the media. The media deserves our condemnation. But at the end of the day, the media is a business, ladies and gentlemen. There's a reason why we call it the corporate media. It's a business. They make money. They have to make money. How do they make money? They perform to a market. So when we sit there and blame everything on NBC News, ABC News, CBS, CNN, Fox, the most honest one of them all. Fox at least says we're performing to a market. This is what the Fox market wants. This is what the Fox market gets. They're the most honest one of them all. PBS is the least honest of them all. PBS says we pretend to be academic, but we're really corporate. We're really going to do the same thing ABC, CBS, and NBC is doing, which is spoon-feeding poison to an audience all too willing to swallow the poison. Ladies and gentlemen, you want to change the media, change the market. By changing the market, that means we, the people, have to define the parameters of what we want. If we set the market, corporate media will respond to the market. In the same way that if we, the people, get involved in the governance of this nation by participating in significant numbers in the electoral process, not just on the day of the election, but leading up to the election, ensuring that the people that are on the ballot are actually reflective of the ideals and values that we embrace, then we will get a government that is truly reflective of the will of the people, as opposed to a government that seems to be more reflective of special interests. But don't condemn special interests, ladies and gentlemen. They're just filling a vacuum created by our own collective apathy. And it's this kind of apathy, this ignorance, that leads to the disaster in Iraq, the lack of planning in Iraq, etc. Condoleezza Rice tells us that there's a difference between Iraq and Iran. How clever. Most Americans will say, of course, one has a Q, one has an N. The more educated amongst us will say, well, one's Arab, one's Persian. But it's the end of the day, ladies and gentlemen, there's no difference between Iraq and Iran when it comes to the Bush administration. Again, thanks to the computer age, leave here tonight, go to Google and type in National Security Strategy of the United States. You can type it in, you're going to get two results, so you can be more selective. First, put September 2002, you'll get the original document. The original document basically defines America's policy vis-a-vis the world is dividing the world into spheres of strategic interest that we can impose our will on economically, diplomatically, and militarily as we see fit in total disregard for international law. It also says that certain areas of the world are regions of special interest. The Middle East is one. And we will seek regional transformation in these regions to remove rogue nations and failed nation states and replace them with Western-leaning democracies. Regime change through the process of preemptive war, ladies and gentlemen. That's the policy of the United States of America as set forth in September 2002. And yet many of us express dismay when the president implemented this policy aggressively in March 2003. It's not as though he didn't warn us, ladies and gentlemen. He spelled it out in a document. Now, people will say, all right, we made a mistake in Iraq. We got that. We got it. Quit beating us up on it. We're not going to make the same mistake in Iran. There's no way this president would dare make a move on Iran right now, given what's going on in Iraq. That's why I say you got to type in that second national security strategy, the one that's dated March 2006, the one that says, we were right to go into Iraq, preemptive war is a just policy. Regime change remains our policy objective. Regional transformation is our goal, and Iran is next. This is the document that lists Iran no fewer than 13 times as representing the number one threat to the security of the United States of America. And it says that this administration will remove the theocracy from power. This is March 2006, ladies and gentlemen. So when we go to war with Iran, please don't say the president didn't warn you. He just told you what he's going to do. And please don't tell me Congress is going to do anything to stop it. Mr. Leahy apparently believes that Iran has unchecked nuclear ambition. Nuclear ambition. Well, they do have nuclear ambition, ladies and gentlemen. They have the ambition to be a nation possessing peaceful nuclear energy in accordance with their lawful rights under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, inclusive of Article 4 that says Iran and any other nation that so wants can acquire the technology related to the full fuel cycle for nuclear power, inclusive of the enrichment of uranium. So when people say Iran's enriching uranium, say yes, they are. Isn't it wonderful? That's what they're allowed to do under Article 4 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And if the United States would respect that, we wouldn't have this problem today. It's not just about our position now, but let's talk about why Iran kept their program secret for 13 years. In 1979, there was the Islamic Revolution. The Shah got booted out, and the Islamists came in, and the United States imposed comprehensive economic sanctions against Iran. Unilateral, it wasn't international, it wasn't a UN sanctioned program, just America. But see, what it means is if you're Siemens, a German company, that is under contract to Iran to go in and build a nuclear reactor, if you build that reactor, you'll be denied the American market because the embargo will be applied to you. So every country, every company that was doing business with Iran had to stop doing business with Iran or be subjected to American sanctions. So now the Iranians have no ability whatsoever to move forward on a nuclear program. Now people say, well, why does Iran need a nuclear program? After all, it's a nation of washing the sea of oil. They got a lot of oil. A whole bunch of the Chinese are buying it up in gobs, or the Indians. We're not. Maybe we want to. But no, they got a lot of oil, ladies and gentlemen. They have an oil-based economy. You know, the Iranians aren't stupid. They're actually pretty smart. You know, Iran is a nation with the highest percentage of internationally peer-reviewed PhD theses in the world today, from the Middle East, outside of Israel. So please don't view the Iranians as a bunch of ragheads who have their heads buried in the sand. These guys go to mathematics contests every year in China. MIT and the California Institute of Technology are lucky if they place in the top 20. The Iranians will get five teams in the top 10. These guys know what they're doing. They're pretty smart. They're so smart, in fact, that they recognized in the mid-1970s that they had a finite supply of oil. And since their entire economy is based on the exportation of oil, they have a requirement in order to maximize their economic benefit, especially recognizing that they have a developing economy that's increasingly using the oil meant for exportation, to develop a domestic alternative to oil for energy needs. And that domestic alternative was nuclear energy. They came to the United States and said, we need to pursue nuclear energy. In fact, a U.S. think tank backed them up on this one. In 1976, the administration of then-President Gerald Ford, a Republican, I might add, agreed with the Iranians. Said, absolutely, we see what's going on here. We understand that in 40 years, you're going to be consuming more oil than you are exporting. You'll be a net importer of oil, which is a disaster for an economy that's based on the exportation of oil. You need nuclear energy. And the Iranians said, yeah, but it's not just nuclear energy. We need the complete fuel cycle. We need to enrich because we can't have the strategic element of our economy held hostage to the vagaries of economic sanctions and embargoes. Now, they ran that through the Defense Department, and the White House Chief of Staff took it through the national security structures of the United States. And the answer came back, yes, we agree. Iran not only needs nuclear energy, but they need to be able to enrich uranium. You know who was the Secretary of Defense in 1976? Donald Rumsfeld. You know who was the White House Chief of Staff? Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld thought in 1976 it was a good idea for Iran to have nuclear power and enrich uranium. But see, the Iran was governed by the Shah back then. Now we got the Islamists, and we didn't allow them to pursue nuclear. But you know what? The basic equation didn't change. The Iranians still needed nuclear energy. They still need nuclear energy. And if they can't get it on the open market, what is a nation to do? Go to the black market. And they did. They went to AQ Khan, the proliferator from Pakistan. You know, Pakistan, our close ally in the global war on terror. AQ Khan sold them the technology and the materiel for the enrichment of uranium. Now, AQ Khan didn't just pop this stuff on his own in own volition in Pakistan. No, he had procured it from around the world himself. And the stuff that he sold the Iranians was his old stuff, the stuff that they had used in support of the Pakistani nuclear bomb, the one Iran doesn't have, but the one Pakistan has. This technology was involved in the enrichment of uranium to weapons-grade level in Pakistan. Much of that technology had been brought in from abroad, including the former Soviet Union and China, where it had been involved in nuclear programs in those countries. Why am I raising all this? The stuff's contaminated, ladies and gentlemen. Contaminated. And then it comes to Iran. The Iranians incorporate it and start using it. And then they get caught. And they say, oh yeah, okay. We got caught, but we're only pursuing peaceful nuclear energy. You're welcome to come in and verify. And guess what the UN inspectors did? They came in and they verified. And they're still there today, verifying. Who read the news reports? Didn't the UN just find traces of enriched uranium and plutonium at Iranian nuclear waste sites? Isn't that the headline? Aren't the Republicans in Arbail screaming nuclear program, nuclear weapons program? It's not the first time the IAEA has found these traces. And every time they found them, the Iranians were able to give a plausible explanation. First of all, let's describe what a trace is. They didn't find a chunk of uranium or a chunk of plutonium. It's not as though the bomb's sitting there at this nuclear waste site. The inspectors go in with basically a kit to take samples. And in that kit, they have these little swabs, cotton swabs. And they swab around, stick it in a test tube, take it back to Vienna, run it through a machine that's capable of detecting things down not to parts per million, but parts per billion. And that's what they found, a part per billion of enriched uranium, a part per billion of enriched plutonium. How'd it get there? The Iranians need to explain it. But in the past, it's always been able to be explained by cross-contamination from this material that's brought in on the black market. So stop panicking, people. They're not close to the bomb. They didn't find stuff that can be used in a bomb. They found a billionth of a part. They have a job to do, and they will investigate it, but it's not panic mode. But remember this. This is not about Iran's nuclear program. This is about regime change. This is about the President of the United States once again exploiting the ignorance of the American public to generate fear to achieve the desired result. And the desired result is the removal of the regime in Tehran through preemptive military action. You think it's fiction? Ask yourself why Prime Minister Ehud Olmert came in from Israel this past week, in a panic to meet with our president. Were they talking about tea? Or were they talking about bombs? They were talking about bombing Iran. The Israeli president said the United States can't get soft just because the Democrats got control of Congress. The Israelis said the United States needs to stay the course on this one. If they ain't the tail wagging the dog, I don't know what is. But that's what's going on, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to go to war with Iran. Now, some people tell you, well, we can't go to war with Iran. We don't have enough troops. How many people here sit in on the Joint Chiefs of Staff war planning meetings? How many people who work for NBC sit in on the war planning meetings? All those talking heads you see out there saying there's not enough troops. How many of those people sit in on the meetings? None. The only opinion that counts are the ones that are making the plan. And we know enough about the plan to know this. They agree we don't have enough troops. But we got enough airplanes. At least they think so. You see, they believe, remember, we're talking about a Bush administration here that can create its own reality. Not just in their own minds, ladies and gentlemen. These are people that are on record saying that the United States can bring to bear diplomatic, economic, and military strength of such force that we can make our own reality. Old reality doesn't matter. Don't you hear the Bush administration always talking about people trapped in old reality? You saw Rumsfeld, old Europe. People say that facts do matter. The president says he can make his own facts up, and he's not just talking about lying. He's talking about the notion that we can create our own reality by bringing to bear the totality of our power. These people believe, or have been led to believe, that the Iranian people are ready, on the cusp of rising up and overthrowing the theocracy in Tehran. All we have to do is give them a helpful push. The helpful push will come in the form of bombs dropped on Iran over the course of several weeks, a sustained aerial bombardment. I used to work as a target here for the U.S. military, and we put that little impact point down there, come up with a PK factor, kill probability, yeah, little CEPs, circular error probability, all the neat little things. How do we determine a target's destroyed? Look on a photograph. If you got a hole in the building, then you assume the bomb went off down the building and you've achieved PK, kill. It's dead. The building's dead. We don't talk about the people in the building. We don't talk about what happens if the bomb falls outside of its circular error probability and hits the market next to the building. No, that's never factored in. But we should know enough about war to know this, that once the bombs start falling, people start dying. And not all the people that are dying are bad people. One only has to take a look at the Israeli bombardment of southern Lebanon to know this to be the case. And one should also know this, that southern Lebanon was meant as a dry run for what we want to do in Iran. And how good did that one go? No, we're going to drop bombs on Iran, ladies and gentlemen. The people of Iran are going to rise up and overthrow the theocracy, as if a people bombed rise up and embrace those who bombed them, especially when the bombs slaughter them in significant numbers, and they will. No, what happens if the aerial campaign doesn't work? Remember, the enemy has a vote. I told you the Iraqi people voted, and our plans didn't go well. What happens when the Iranian peoples vote with their finger? And they will. All those tunnel networks that Hezbollah used to confound the Israeli Defense Force were dug by the Iranians. You think they're not digging them in their own home? 70 million people in Iran, as opposed to 22 million people in Iraq. 2.5 times the landmass. How many targets can you possibly pick the bomb on that one? There's only 12 nuclear targets. After that, what are you going to hit? We're guessing. We're just going to drop bombs and hope that something happens. And it won't. So now what? We've committed. What are the Iranians going to do? Sit back and say, please bomb us some more? I think on day one, the Iranians are going to respond by firing missiles against Israel. Then they're going to respond by firing missiles against every oil installation within range. And then they're going to send their proxies into Iraq to slaughter American troops in Iraq. And then they're going to dare us to come in. And we're going to have to come in because the aerial bombardment's not going to work. Not only that, we won't be able to sustain it for weeks. Why? Because the Iranians will play the oil weapon. They will take their oil off the market, 2.5 to 3 million barrels a day. They will shut down the Straits of Hormuz, denying the world 20 to 30% of the oil it needs to survive. And what happens when there's no oil to feed the international addiction to oil? You've all gone on eBay. You know when they bring up that popular item that you just saw? What's that new PlayStation thing? You put it on eBay, everybody starts bidding for it, a finite resource that everybody wants. The price goes up. If you think people are going to pay through the teeth for a PlayStation, what are they going to pay for oil when their basic life demands they have oil? Right now, the international market operates at 1 to 1.5% excess capacity. You take the Iranian oil off the market, you take the Persian Gulf oil off the market, the Venezuelans pull their oil off the market, we're down to -25 to -30%. That means there's not nearly enough oil to feed the addiction. You think the Chinese and the Indians are going to stop their development of their economy because America went to war against Iran? Yeah, the world's going to say, we'll stop using oil, we'll divert it all to America, so they're not inconvenienced by this. No, we're going to be inconvenienced, ladies and gentlemen. The price of oil is going to go through the roof. Saudi oil analysts have said within a week of a war with Iran, the price of oil could be $250 a barrel. And after that point, it doesn't matter because it becomes totally irrational and totally irrelevant. Because once you get the prices that high, our economy no longer functions. Because this is an oil-based economy. Everything we have here is priced based upon oil. Our electricity, our food, everything is derived from that price. And when we're paying $250, We might as well be paying 500 because we're going to be printing money like crazy. Open up your wallets. You don't have to. I'll do it. Ooh, I can go buy a pizza. And a beer. I got some money in here. I'm okay. Just a little bit of green in here goes a long way. You'll need a wheelbarrow full of money to buy a loaf of bread if we go to war with Iran. How long do you think the American public is going to sustain that, Mr. President? Hey, thanks for bombing Iran. Thanks for ruining our economy. You keep up the course, Mr. President. We're behind you 100%. No, they're going to be screaming for his head. So now he's got to win the war. But the aerial bombardment's not going to work. So what's the next step? Ground troops. But we don't have enough to occupy Iran. You're right. We don't. You know, the military today basically is broken into thirds. They talk about an overstretched military. One third of our forces today are committed to fighting the global war on terror. They're out there doing their job. The other third's coming back from fighting the global war on terror. They got to rest and re-equip. The other third's getting ready to go fight the global war on terror. And they basically just rotate like this. Makes it very difficult to get people trained. It's hard to pull units out and train them properly. Think about the next conflict. We're so focused on the current conflict. We're destroying our military as we speak. To go to Iran, we're basically going to take these guys here and gals that are preparing to go to fight the global war on terror, and we're going to shoot them forward into Iran. That means we got one shot, ladies and gentlemen. This isn't something we get to cycle through. We go in and we got to win, but we don't have that many troops. The Marine Corps says they can probably put 30,000 troops into the Straits of Hormuz. Bandar Abbas, Chabahar, seize the Straits of Hormuz. And knowing the Marine Corps, they're going to do it. Those boys are going to hit the beach, and God help anybody that gets in their way. But there's only 20,000 of them. They can't go all the way. They're going to stop. And that's it. There's nothing more to come in and help them. The Army, they're pretty motivated, these pros. They're going to shoot a corps, about 60 to 80,000 troops, into Azerbaijan, run them down the Caspian Sea coast to the outskirts of Tehran, making a lot of noise, telling the Iranian people, rise up, overthrow those theocrats. USA, USA. And the Iranians are going to go, no. And they're going to fight us. And now we're going to be stuck outside this Tehran with a long line of communication going back to Azerbaijan that's easy to cut off. And we got 100,000 troops in harm's way, plus 150,000 troops bogged down in Iraq. And no cavalry to come and get them. There ain't John Wayne. He's not there. We used them already. And they're in real danger now. Then what do we do? Surrender? No. There's a reason why the president developed the class of nuclear weapons called usable nuclear weapons. There's a reason why the president came up with a new policy to use nuclear weapons that says we can use nuclear weapons preemptively in a non-nuclear environment if certain conditions exist, one of which is significant numbers of American troops placed in harm's way. We're going to drop the bomb, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to drop the bomb. America's going to use a nuclear weapon against Iran. And after that, it's over. Pakistan, that close personal friend of the United States of America, has a military that's probably about 60% of Islamic fundamentalists, along with their intelligence services. They're the number one supporter of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda today. Imagine that. American troops fighting and dying in Afghanistan, while our good friend Pakistan's training the enemies that are killing them and sending them over the border to kill more Americans. Pakistan's sitting on 20 to 40 nuclear weapons. They have material for probably another 40 to 60 others stockpiled away. Musharraf falls and the Islamists get a hold of that weapon, you think you're going to sit there and say, we're going to be very rational here, and we're not going to share this capability with anybody who seeks to get revenge on the United States for preemptively using a nuclear weapon without excuse on an Islamic country. No. They're going to be handing that stuff out like candy on Halloween. They're going to be saying, take them out, take them out, take them out. And they will take us out. So you want to go to war with Iran? Pick an American city. Anyone you want. Burlington? They aren't going to come here. They might go to New York City. They might go to Boston. Anywhere you got those big container ships coming in that nobody inspects. And then pop goes the weasel and down go several million Americans. And then it's all over. Because once you nuke us, we nuke everything. And then we come back to global, you know, the whole issue of, you know, nuclear winter and all that stuff. And maybe the human race dies off and we did Mother Nature a big favor, getting rid of the globe's biggest parasite. I don't know. But the bottom line is, it doesn't bode well for the future of this country. A war with Iran cannot be won. There is no reason for us to speak of waging a war with Iran. But if you think the American Congress is going to do something, think again. The Dan Leahys of the world, everybody else, have already bought into the president's working assumption about Iran. There is nothing that separates the Democrats and the Republicans on the issue of Iran. And the American people have also swallowed the poison. 70% of the American people believe Iran is pursuing a nuclear weapons program. Of these 70%, more than 68% say that the preferred course of action is economic sanctions through the United Nations. But what happens if the United Nations doesn't accept sanctions? Like if the Russians, for instance, don't want to play a game, like they're doing right now. If you've accepted that a threat exists worthy of international intervention, and international intervention fails to occur, what's the only course of action left? War. War. It's not just war, though, ladies and gentlemen. It's the preemptive use of military aggression. Now, why do I use those terms, preemptive military aggression? Because it's terminology that's set forth by the Nuremberg Tribunal in 1946. Terminology that convicted German generals and German politicians for crimes against humanity, war crimes, the ultimate war crime, as established by Judge Henry Jackson, U.S. Supreme Court Justice, head of the Nuremberg Tribunal. A preemptive war of aggression. Those who plan and implement a preemptive war of aggression are guilty of the supreme war crime. And we talk about American citizenship, I'll tell you what status we all hold today. We are citizens of a nation that has perpetrated the supreme war crime in Iraq and is being prepared to perpetrate the same crime in Iran. And it is guilt by association, ladies and gentlemen. It is guilt by association. If we go to war with Iran, it's not just George W. Bush that should be hung by the neck until dead. It's not just every member of the United States Congress. It's basically the United States of America itself, because we will have proved that we are indeed the greatest threat the world faces today. And that's a bad thing to say about a nation that possesses so much hope, so much promise, a nation that claims to embrace ideals and values that all should aspire to. And indeed, there was a time in this world when people did aspire to be just like America. But today, if you want to be just like America, you have to be prepared to kill your neighbor without excuse. You have to be prepared to torture your own citizens. You have to be prepared to destroy that which you claim to stand for. Ladies and gentlemen, that is not my America. That should not be your America. And we need to work together to ensure that doesn't happen. Thank you very much. Thanks. So now that I hope I've sufficiently challenged you, and now you get to hold me to account, my favorite part of the evening. Anybody have any questions? Yes, sir. Oh, we'll get to you.